The Norse had their heroes that sometimes became gods or were gods themselves, but man has always celebrated heroes, even not just fictional, but historical heroes. Even we as a nation that have only been around on this earth for 300 years have our heroes, whether they be generals or admirals such as George Washington or Chester Nimitz. Sometimes they're individual heroes who have performed great feats and accomplishments on the battlefield, such as Alvin York or Audie Murphy. But we know that the greatest heroes are those who do the Lord's work, those who stand up and do what is right, even though it is inconvenient to them, even though it poses a danger, maybe physically or otherwise. But those heroes, those Bible heroes, those who have, in the Lord's name, done the Lord's work with the Lord's backing. Now, we're going to look at Bible heroes not specifically tonight, but categorically. That is, as a group, and we're going to look at certain aspects of what it meant to be a Bible hero, or what it means to be a Bible hero. Now, one of the things that we know about Bible heroes is that oftentimes, very often, in fact, I would say always, they are outnumbered, sometimes greatly outnumbered. Let's start tonight in the book of Judges, chapter 15. We're going to start with Samson. Now, we could read a lot about Samson, but we're just going to read this short section because, like I said, we're going through the heroes categorically tonight, not so much specifically. But we see in chapter 15 of Judges, starting in verse 14, it says, "When he, Samson, came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, reached out his hand and took it, and killed 1,000 men with it. Then Samson said, 'With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men.' And so it was, when he had finished speaking, that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called that place Ramath-Lehi." So here, Samson has taken up a jawbone, which is a pretty crude bludgeon-type weapon that you, if you had your choice of weapons, the jawbone of a donkey would not be what I would choose to defend myself. Pretty crude weapon. He took it up, slew 1,000 men. That doesn't mean he fought against 1,000 men. There could have been 1,000 more, or 1,000 is how many that he killed. We don't know how many ran away after seeing 1,000 of their number killed with a donkey's jawbone. So, could have been more than 1,000. Maybe he killed them to the last man, but at least it was 1 versus 1,000. That's pretty good odds for being outnumbered there. Yet we see in verse 14, it wasn't him that did it, but it says the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. Spirit of the Lord was definitely involved in this incident with the Philistines. Let's also go over to Judges chapter 7. Let's look at Gideon. Judges chapter 7. Now to preface this, to mention secularly, we have probably all heard the story of the Spartans and the 300 Spartans that held off the Persians at the Battle of Thermopylae. And the Spartans were a very warlike people. They trained their men from a very young age in all of the arts of war. Very harsh training, in which they underfed them and taught them self-reliance, to sneak food, to take care of themselves where others would not. And so they fought this battle in Thermopylae against several thousand Persians. Eventually they all perished, but they had a lot of things going for them. Not only were they were in a very strategic location, it was a bottleneck in which only a small amount of the full force of the Persians could get to them, but they had years and years of experience. They were the superior quality in training in their force versus the Persians. And even with all that, they still perished and died. And yet, the story of Gideon, before the 300 Spartans, there was Gideon and his 300. And they were not a superior fighting force. In fact, the force that they went up against was the premier force of that area, of that day, that had better training, better skills, better weapons. But we see here, let's start in verse 2 of Judges 7. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" So already the premise, Gideon had too many men. He needed less men. And we see that he cuts it down to 300 men. Now, it doesn't say at first, we'll read later, the size of the force that Gideon went up against. We'll see that in chapter 8. But if we go to verse 12, it reads, "Now the Midianites and the Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley, as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number as the sands by the seashore in multitude." So the point is he is vastly outnumbered. He has 300 men, and he's vastly outnumbered by thousands upon thousands. We'll see, like I said, in chapter 8, it'll give us better specific numbers of what he went against. But we see here in 22, said, "When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp, and the army fled to Bethekiah toward Zerera, as far as the border of Abel-Meholah by Tabith. And the men of Israel gathered together from Naphtali, Asher, and all Manasseh, and pursued the Midianites." So they routed, this 300 men routed this army of thousands upon thousands. Let's go over to chapter 8 now. We see in verse 4 of chapter 8 that after this great battle, after thousands upon thousands were defeated in battle, verse 4, "When Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted, but still in pursuit." He still had his 300 men, whereas the Spartans had all perished in their battle against something like 3,000 Persians. Here, Gideon still has his 300 intact with him in pursuit. The army that routed, he is still in pursuit of this host, this force that was many times greater than him, even though they were just a remnant of the army that was destroyed. And we see here, down to verse 10, we get an idea of what kind of numbers we're talking here. Now, Zeba and Zalmunna were at Karkur, and their armies with them, about 15,000. All who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. So they were 300 chasing a force of 15,000, which was the remnant of an army that had lost 120,000 men. So that was about 135,000 men originally. Now, these are pretty big numbers. Trying to imagine this in your head, the difference between 300 men versus 15,000, much less 135,000. So we see here that, once again, Bible heroes are outnumbered, and not just in a small way, but in a vast scale, where the only possible course of victory is with God's divine intervention. If we think about it in terms today, if we had 300 of the most elite battle-trained men with the best equipment ready to fight in hand-to-hand combat, perhaps with rifles, guns, if we had 300 of the best soldiers today and they went up against an army of 135,000 men with sticks and rocks, they would lose just by sheer force of numbers. The men with the sticks and the rocks would overwhelm them. Doesn't matter, they wouldn't have enough bullets. They would not be able to overcome or defeat such a force. And yet, Gideon and his 300 routed them, pursued them, defeated them again. So, this is a perfect example how, with God, it doesn't matter how many there is of man. That these Bible heroes are always outnumbered because God's purpose is to show his hand, is to show his glory. Let's go to 1 Kings. Let's talk about Elijah. Now, Elijah was not a warrior like Gideon or Samson. He did not take up a sword. But yet, in his battle, which may be even more similar to what we experience today than Gideon and Samson, but his battle, he was still outnumbered. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 18. We'll start in verse 22. First Kings 18, starting in 22, this reads, "Then Elijah said to the people, 'I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men.'" Now, this kind of rings true to us today. Though we are not alone as Elijah was, we are very few in number compared to the world, the secular world that we must go out into. So he still had better odds than we do today. If you know, you went on a one Christian to how many non-Christian ratio that we have to spiritually do combat with. But let's read on here. After he has declared, "Is just one of him and a bunch of them," we see here in verse 24 the stipulation of the argument. "Then you call on the name of your gods, I'll call on the name of the Lord, the God who answers by fire, he is God." So all the people answered, said, "It is well spoken. This is a great idea." So, excuse me. 450 to get their God's attention versus one man to get his God's attention. And of course, we see in verse 29, when midday was past, the 450 prophets of Baal, they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. So the 450, they failed. They had all the time in the world. They did some pretty crazy stuff to try to get their God's attention. And of course, he remains silent because he doesn't exist. And we go to verse 36. We see, "And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah, the prophet, came near and said, 'Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word.'" In 38, "Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust. It was licked up the water that was in the trench." Here, Elijah, he fought a different type of battle, right? But he was still outnumbered, and it didn't matter. Because if you have the truth, if you are right, it doesn't matter how outnumbered you are. God is on your side as long as you're on his. So, we know Bible heroes, they're going to be outnumbered. We know also another aspect about Bible heroes that we see often is that they bring an unpopular message. The words that they bring coming from the Lord are not always well received. Jonah was lucky, but oftentimes it is not the same case. Let's go to, well, I shouldn't say Jonah was lucky. It was the God's will that he went there because he knew that they would be open to him. But what I mean to say is Jonah was an exception where oftentimes the prophets of the Lord are persecuted. They bring in an unpopular message. Let's go to the book of Acts. The book of Acts, chapter 6. Acts chapter 6, and let's start in verse 8. "And Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and signs among the people. Then there arose some from what is called the synagogue of the freedmen, and those from Cilicia, or Cyrenians, Alexandrians, and those from Cilicia and Asia, disputing with Stephen. And they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spoke." Stephen came, doing great wonders and signs, and they were not able to resist his wisdom that he spoke with. The Spirit gave him the wisdom with which to speak. Here in verse 10. Now we see Stephen goes into a pretty good recount of all the all the persecution that their ancestors had brought upon all the different prophets that had come before. And he concludes it pretty powerfully in such a way that in verse 54, it says, when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart and they gnashed at him with their teeth, because they didn't. His message was pretty unpopular, and not only because it wasn't what they wanted to hear, but it said that it cut them to the heart because it was true and they could not defend against it. So, in verse 57, they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, and ran at him with one accord, and they cast him out of the city and stoned him. So, Stephen, even though he knew what he had to say was very unpopular, he still said it because that's what is expected of those who do the Lord's work. So, in 57, I imagine, you know, it's kind of almost brings a childish image to my mind of them just clapping their hands over their ears and shouting, going, "No, no, 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 we can't hear you," as they ran at him because they were so filled, they just could not endure listening to him any longer. Even though what he said was perfectly true, we know that the Bible heroes are oftentimes unpopular, or they bring a very unpopular message. Let's also go to the book, back to 1 Kings, this time to chapter 22. And let's start with verse 6. This, to set the stage here, what's happening is the king of Israel has called up the king of Jerusalem because he wants him to go to war together against Syria. And so he wants Jehoshaphat, the king of Jerusalem, is like, well, let's make sure, you know, we get the Lord's input on this. And so at this time, though, most of the prophets do not speak for the Lord. We see in verse 6, then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead to fight, or shall I refrain? So they said, go up, for the Lord will deliver it into the hand of the king. And Jehoshaphat said, is there not still a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him? So the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, there is still one man, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him because he does not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say such things. So here the king doesn't like Micaiah because he doesn't say nice things about him, even though he is the lone, what they have agreed to here, that he's the lone prophet who speaks of the Lord, you know, that should give the king a pretty good idea of where he stands if Micaiah says things that are not good about what he does, and he's the prophet of the Lord. But anyways, let's move on to verse 17. 17 tells us, then he said, Micaiah, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master, let each return to his house in peace. So his 400 other prophets said, go up, the Lord will deliver him into your hands. And Micaiah, the lone voice, says that it's not going to be so, that they're not going to be successful. And we see here, later on in verse 23, he says, therefore, look, the Lord has put a lion's spirit in the mouth of all these prophets of yours, and the Lord has declared disaster against you. So Micaiah was outnumbered by the prophets in his words of truth, where they all said, go up, the Lord will be with you. Micaiah, who spoke from the Lord, was the one voice that said, no disaster will befall you. Now, what happened after that was one of the other prophets came up and struck him for disagreeing with them, and the king of Israel had Micaiah put into prison until the time that they would return from the battle. So Micaiah brought a pretty unpopular message there. He was outnumbered, and his message was very unpopular. But Bible heroes are not just outnumbered and unpopular. What do they do? But another aspect of Bible heroes is that they save others. Just like heroes in secular stories, one of the biggest things they do, they save people who cannot save themselves. They protect those who are weak, or they defend those who can't defend themselves. Bible heroes save others. Now let's go to John chapter 3 and verse 17. John 3:17. Speaking, of course, this is Jesus speaking here. He says, "For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved." So Jesus, of course, being the ultimate of the Bible heroes. In fact, to the point that whenever you're discussing with somebody, "Oh, who's your favorite Bible hero?" you usually have to preface it with, "Aside from Jesus, of course, because Jesus is the best. He was the only perfect one. Aside from Jesus, who's your favorite?" Because it's almost blasphemy to say, "Well, Jesus isn't my favorite. My favorite's..." You know, so aside from Jesus, who's your favorite? But here we see that God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. So God sent Jesus to save others. Even those who mocked Jesus on the cross, when they said that he could not save himself, even though they were wrong in that regard, they admitted he saved others. When they said he saved others, but he cannot save himself. So even they knew that Jesus had come and had saved others and had come to save others. Let's also go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And the second half of 22, Paul is admitting, he's saying, "I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." So he's talking about how he serves others, how he relates to others, to the Jew, I became a Jew, to the Gentile, a Gentile. He concludes it by saying, "I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." Bible heroes are there to save others. Let's go to James chapter 5. James chapter 5, and let's start in verse 19. 19 and 20 reads, "Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." So an aspect of being a Bible hero involves selfless service, serving others in order to save them. And of course, Bible heroes oftentimes do battle with evil. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6, starting in verse 10, reads, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand, or may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." Oftentimes, Bible heroes are called to do battle against evil, or to strive to wrestle against wickedness. We also see it in Romans chapter 12 and 21. Romans 12, 21, which reads, "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." So we are to overcome evil. And of course, to be a Bible hero requires courage. That is a trait among many heroes, biblical, non-biblical, fictional, historical, is that courage was required. The purpose, the ability to do something in the face of danger oftentimes, or in the face of adversity, requires courage. And as Christians, as followers of God, where did they get their courage from but trust in God? From Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who defied Nebuchadnezzar when they said, "We will not worship your God or you. We will be saved by God. Even if he does not save us, we will not worship you or your God." They were unapologetically defiant. They had courage which stemmed from trust in God. They knew God had their back. We have a placard that we hang up that God, or that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. This courage comes from our trust in God, our knowledge that he has our back. Look at the story of David and Goliath. And under normal circumstances, it was an improbable match. And yet, it was because of David's trust in God that he won that battle. David even says in epic fashion that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, but rather the battle is the Lord's and he will deliver you into our hands. Very epic thing for this little young lad to say when he goes up to battle against a giant. So they took their courage from God. It was courage, it was trust in God that brought Moses back into Egypt after he had fled it. It was courage that brought all these Bible heroes into our books, into the Bible for us to read about today. The courage to stand up, to know that God has your back and that they're going to do right whatever may happen. And so the point of tonight's lesson is that we are today's Bible heroes. We will be outnumbered. Our message will be unpopular, yet we must go do battle with the evil of this world in order to save others. Our courage stems from our trust in God, our trust that God will save us, whether it be in this life or the next. If what we say leads to our death in this life, we will be saved spiritually in the next life. So either way, God always has our back. Amen. God has blessed us with gifts and abilities, but unlike the popularized superheroes, these gifts and abilities are of a spiritual nature. Let's go to Romans chapter 12. Verse 6 and 8 read, or 6 through 8 read, "Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. If prophecy, let us prophesy in proportion to our faith. Or ministry, let us use it in our ministering. He who teaches in teaching. He who exhorts in exhortation. He who gives with liberality. He who leads with diligence. He who shows mercy with cheerfulness." We also see in 1 Corinthians, talking about how we use our gifts, how we use our abilities that God has given us. 1 Corinthians 12, starting in verse 4, he says, "There are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are differences of ministries, but the same Lord. And there are diversities of activities, but it is the same God who works all in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge through the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by the same Spirit, to another the working of miracles, to another prophecy, to another discerning of spirits, to another different kinds of tongues, to another the interpretation of tongues, but one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributing to each one individually as He wills. We all have different abilities. We all have different gifts that God has given us, yet we all have them. There's no one here that is giftless, that does not have a way that they can do the Lord's work. We all here are today's Bible heroes. Though we will not be famous, we are Bible heroes because we courageously carry the Bible into battle with Christ as our banner. We are Bible heroes. Though our names and deeds will not be written in a book of history for the whole world to read of them, our names will be written in a book of life that God will read to the world. If there are any here tonight who wish to become a member of the Lord's church, who wish to be one of these Bible heroes that we read about, that is us today. We are these characters in this book. We are fighting overwhelming odds. We are outnumbered, unpopular in our message, yet we are there to save others. We are there to to bring others to Christ, despite what it may mean to us, despite daunting odds. So if there are any here tonight who perhaps need the prayers of the congregation, or whatever that need is, please let it be known as we stand to sing the song of invitation.